Part 2. Chapter 5. Rescue Plans. Yusuf whirls on Andromache as soon as they're safely left alone in the shared drawing room of their guest quarters. "Why did you do that?" he demands, throwing up his hands to release some of the energy thrumming through him. "Is it not clear that he's suffered enough?" She opens her mouth to speak, but he's still going. "Did you see how they dragged him with those chains? The way Gabor pulled his hair." He paces the room, hands at his hair. "He's starved, and they've been throwing him into the ring to fight, and Gabor calls him his beast." Yusuf struggles for words. An uncommon occurrence, but he's too riled up now to speak with his usual eloquence. "It was appalling, disgusting. I will never understand people who can be cruel like that. So tell me, what were you thinking?" Yusuf stops in his tracks to wait for Andromache's answer. She frowns at him, crossing her arms. "Are you done?" He frowns right back. Unlike her controlled stillness, he can't stop the anxious tapping of his foot. "Yes," he says reluctantly. "I needed to see if he was truly like us," Andromache explains briskly. "If he was, then he would return from a nearly painless death. And if he was not..." Quinn speaks up from her sprawl across an embroidered lounge, her relaxed position at odds with her solemn tone. "Then he deserved an easy death," she says simply. The outrage drains out of Yusuf in an instant, and he slumps. "Yes," he agrees. "He has earned an easy death." "Haven't we all?" Andromache comments. Ignoring the pair of carved wooden chairs at her side, she sits down on the plush rug and leans up against the wall, her legs stretched out in front of her. "But didn't you recognize him?" Yusuf asks. "Why did you need to test it if our dreams show us each other?" She raises an eyebrow. "The dreams are dreams, Yusuf. We get flashes. Over time, we built up a better image, but it's not the same as seeing the person before you. Perhaps you, with your artist's eye, can remember a face from your dreams a year later, but not all of us are so focused on aesthetics." He rolls his eyes at the familiar jab. Over their months together, the women have found great pleasure in teasing him ever since they learned of his interest in art and his appreciation for a pretty face. "Besides," Andromache continues more seriously, "the man we saw in our dreams was different." "He still looked like he could use a few good meals," Quinn recalls, "and he wasn't exactly the picture of cleanliness. But compared to what we just saw," she shakes her head, "big difference. And we could barely even see his face past all the hair." "I recognized him," Yusuf protests. The women turn to him as one, faces alight with amusement. He frowns at them and waves aside their teasing before they can open their mouths. "Yes, yes, all right. My artist's eye, or whatever." "I'm sure that's all it was," Quinn says with exaggerated sincerity. He shoots her a rude gesture and tries to get them back on track. "Anyway, we know that it really is him. So what are we going to do about it? How do we help?" "I thought you didn't care for him," Andromache remarks casually. "I don't," Yusuf says immediately. He frowns at her. "He invaded lands that weren't his and killed innocents in the name of his god. Of course I don't care for him." "Then why are you so upset?" Yusuf throws up his hands. "Because this is torture. Worse." "So you want to see him freed?" Yusuf pauses to frown at her some more. "Did you think I would go back on my promise to help?" "No," Andromache says with a shrug. "Only asking." He eyes her suspiciously, but in the end, he decides to drop it. Whatever game she's playing, he refuses to engage. "No one deserves this," he says firmly. "That doesn't mean I want to make friends with him." She only hums and closes her eyes, leaning her head back against the wall. Yusuf doesn't think he can sit still. He's haunted by those eyes, that striking gaze that he would still recognize after 1,000 years apart, the last thing he ever saw as his first life came to a sudden bloody end. Eyes that have followed him around every corner of his nightmares. Eyes that today were just as furious and piercing as they were before the gates of Al-Quds. Eyes that paused on Yusuf for an endless handful of heartbeats, their gaze holding and building up into what felt like a bonfire between them. "I think he recognized me," Yusuf says. Andromache snorts. "No shit," Quinn says. "You're the only person he didn't look at like he wanted to kill them." Yusuf turns to her, startled. "Then what did he look like looking at me?" She shrugs loosely. "Like he knew you and was surprised to see you. We didn't exactly part on good terms." "He didn't look happy to see you," Andromache puts in, "just surprised." "Haunted, maybe," Quinn suggests, tapping her chin with exaggerated thoughtfulness. Yusuf rolls his eyes. "Yes, I'm haunting him. What gave it away, my pale complexion?" Quinn snickers and he grins back at her. It's a relief to smile, even as he feels guilty for pushing aside the suffering he just witnessed. "He was a Christian invader, right?" Andromache says. "He might believe in ghosts or demons." The smile slips from Yusuf's face. He remembers that word. It was screamed at him on that day when everything changed in various languages he didn't really speak. Demon, demone, daemon. Not by this man, this prisoner, no. Yusuf has yet to hear him say a single word, but by plenty of others, after Yusuf awoke on the battlefield and took up his sword again for lack of a better idea, when he staggered but failed to fall after a deep stab to his gut, when he was slaughtered by a group of four only to rise and follow them back down the street a minute later, when he stumbled out of a burning house with a dying child in his arms and flames licking at his skin. Yes, he has been called that word before. He does not particularly wish to hear it directed at him again. "Well," he says after too long of a silence, "I suppose he's not going to trust me to break him out." He glances to Andromache. "Nor you, after that. Short of freeing him on the spot, I doubt we could have done anything to gain his trust in that moment," Quinn points out. She wrinkles her nose. "Likely not even that. He might be too far gone." "Gone?" Yusuf echoes. Andromache is nodding, but he doesn't understand. "What do you mean?" Quinn hesitates, looking for the words. She shifts her position, moving to stand upright on the lounge, a sign that she's taking this seriously. "He isn't just a prisoner," she starts. "This is a unique situation." "Not many prisoners can be killed multiple times," Yusuf agrees. "He has been tortured for longer than anyone else could be." She purses her lips. "It's more than that." Andromache takes out her axe and idly begins to examine its edge. "You heard how Gabor didn't feed him for a couple months. It was unintentional. He said he just forgot about him." Yusuf doesn't need the reminder. "And?" he prompts. "Gabor is a collector," she says, ignoring his impatience. "He surrounds himself with anything that interests him. He has an entire menagerie. Even something like us can't hold his attention forever. He has other toys." Andromache's mouth twists. "So this man, when he's not entertaining Gabor, he's tossed aside. No food, no water. The darkest hole in the dungeon." She and Quinn exchange a long look that Yusuf can't decipher. "You would be surprised how important it is to not be alone," Quinn says finally, "to speak to another person, to hear a kind word, or feel a comforting touch." Andromache reaches out to squeeze Quinn's hand, her eyes grave. "Locked up in the dark, without anything, anything at all, where nothing ever changes and no one hears your cries, and you can no longer tell what time it is." She shakes her head. "It would drive a person mad." Yusuf looks between the women. He has a sinking feeling that he has been underestimating how bad the situation is. "But they haven't left him in there all the time," he points out half-heartedly. "No," Andromache says, too lightly. "They also bring him out to make him fight to the death and to parade him in front of strangers like an exotic pet, gagged and naked and tortured for sport." She sends Yusuf a pointed look. "Do you think that would help you feel more human?" He says nothing. She doesn't press the point further, just sits back and resumes her examination of her weapon. "We are not meant to be alone," she says, so quietly that Yusuf barely hears her. He doesn't know what to say to this either. He can hear eons in her voice, and it frightens him. He thinks suddenly of Lycan, of what they told Yusuf that first night they found him. He wonders if one day he will be left without Quinn and Andromache, if he will be alone for countless lifetimes. "That is why we will free him," Quinn declares, breaking through his rapidly spiraling thoughts. Her sudden smile is fierce, and her words possessive. "He belongs with us." Yusuf sinks down into one of the chairs Andromache had spurned. He wouldn't say he's eager for the man to join their group. He loves their little family already, and his only direct interaction with the other immortal was pretty much the worst possible situation. But when the women described their dreams, the picture they spun of a lost, kind stranger clashed so starkly with the invader who had killed Yusuf. And then they find out that he has been held prisoner, killed and tortured for amusement for a year now. Of course Yusuf wants to free him. He would not wish the man's fate on anyone. This rescue mission is exactly the sort of thing he and Andromache and Quinn best like to perform. It's especially pleasing when they get to annoy someone like Gabor while helping innocents. This man is not wholly innocent, he reminds himself, but he does not deserve this cruelty, nor is it fair to condemn him without trial to a madman's whims as punishment for his sins in the Holy Land. So Yusuf will help free him, and he will use this opportunity to take a second look at his killer. Perhaps he will see something of the stranger from the second-hand dreams, and perhaps he will not. Only time will tell. That is, if the man can recover from the madness which the women claim has inevitably befallen him. Only time will tell that, too. Luckily, they have plenty of it. "How do you propose to handle this?" he speaks up, setting aside his musings. "We can try to speak to him tomorrow. Gabor did not forbid us from seeing him at all, only from overexerting him." Andromache and Quinn exchange another look. "What?" Yusuf asks, exasperated. "I don't think he will be part of the planning committee," Quinn says mildly. "We likely cannot speak to him." "Between the three of us, we know quite a few languages," Yusuf argues. "Andromache, don't you speak Frankish?" She shakes her head, but not in answer. "He may not be capable," she means. "If he is, fine, but we must plan as though he's not." Yusuf frowns. "But if we don't communicate our intentions, then we'll just look like we're abducting him. He will not go quietly, not if today is any indication." Andromache grins. "He does have spirit, doesn't he? I like it." Then she turns serious again. "But yes, that will make our job harder." She sets her axe aside and leans her head back against the wall. "So, plans." "We can steal a horse on the way out, so we have four," Quinn says immediately, always ready to obtain a new horse. "Though he may not be able to ride at first, we'll need to gather supplies for a hard ride in case they chase us." "We're decent enough on food," Andromache says, "but we need to refill our water." Some horse feed would not go unappreciated. Yusuf thinks through the contents of their saddlebags, considering what items cannot be stretched to a fourth person. "Perhaps some clothes for him." Andromache waves a hand dismissively. "Not a priority, but fine." Yusuf rolls his eyes and makes a mental note to search for some trousers. If the man is going to have clothes to wear, it might be up to Yusuf. Perhaps he can find some in the laundry. "Rope," Andromache continues grimly. "Ideally, those chains they had on him." Yusuf's head snaps up. "What for?" he asks warily. "We have to be ready to subdue him," Quinn says, with the barest hint of apology in her voice. "If he can't understand us, we don't have time to teach him to understand," agrees Andromache, totally unapologetically. "We just take him." Yusuf sends a glare toward Andromache and a beseeching look to Quinn, but to no avail. He knows they're right, anyway, on a practical level. Their top priority will have to be getting the man and themselves out of here safely. If that means tying him up and dragging him along unwillingly, well, that is what they will have to do. But he doesn't have to like it. "I don't wish to treat a human being as a beast," he mutters, rubbing anxiously at his beard. Quinn leans over to punch his arm. "You think we do?" she asks, playing up her offense in an obvious attempt to cheer him. He rubs his bicep, even though it stopped hurting practically before it started. "No," he admits. "Of course not. It's just weighing heavily on my heart." "There will always be people who do despicable things," Andromache says flatly. She stares at the wall, perhaps seeing some of the terrible sights she has witnessed over her long lifetime. "There will always be people who do good things, too," Yusuf reminds her softly. She blinks, shakes her head, and turns to raise her eyebrows at him. "So glad to hear it," she says dryly. Most people would shy away from her well-practiced look of disdain, but Yusuf has the benefit of knowing her much better than most people. He can see the smile she's hiding. "I guess it's our turn to do good," Quinn sighs gustily, feigning disappointment. Andromache, who can never resist Quinn, breaks and flashes her a smile. Then she gets back down to business. "We do it during the festival. That will give us the most cover. Plenty of drunk guards, some rich visitors who might want him for themselves, suspects." Frowning, Yusuf starts to speak, but she cuts him off. "Gabor said he would need to be left alone until after the fight, remember? He will be fine here for another few days." "Fine is a relative term," Yusuf argues. He hesitates, glancing away as though he can avoid those words from Gabor that are still echoing in his ears. He said his mouth is unavailable, Yusuf says finally, the oily phrase dripping unpleasantly from his lips. He looks up and meets Andromache's gaze, then Quinn's. They wear matching expressions of tight anger and disgust, but they do not flinch from his words, meeting the reality head on. "He said that he has cut the man's dick off," Yusuf winces instinctively at the thought, "and that he will not please you as well as he could me," he spits, hiding a shudder of revulsion, "since he will not obey with his mouth either." Andromache nods, slowly closing her eyes as a hand automatically creeps toward her axe. Quinn sits very still. He. Yusuf cuts himself off, no longer sure what he's trying to say. They all understood Gabor's offer. Once the festival is over, his guests will have no limit to their access to his beast. Death, disembowelment, disfigurement, and whatever else they want to do to him. "I'm going to cut Gabor's dick off," Quinn says, almost pleasantly. Andromache opens her eyes to glance fondly at her. "We may not have time." "We will make time," Quinn threatens. It's an empty threat, and they all know it. The safest way out of here is to leave long before anyone realizes. "You will have to fight me for the pleasure," Yusuf says, instead of pointing this out. "You two have fun with his dick," Andromache drawls. "I want his head." "What do you think, Yusuf?" Quinn asks, cocking her head to one side. "Does Lord Gabor have enough dick for us to share?" Andromache snorts and Quinn grins over at her. But Yusuf has to force a smile onto his face, stuck crudely wondering if their fourth member knows the answer to that question. He itches to get out of here. He wants to leave this distastefully opulent castle and its poisonous owner far behind. And, thinking of the desperate, caged look in the man's eyes, Yusuf can't wait to get him out of here either. Chapter 6. So We Meet Again. Yusuf is decidedly not enjoying his stay at Lord Gabor's castle. Thankfully, they have not been expected to spend every waking minute in Gabor's company. The first morning, a servant brings them breakfast in their rooms. Without prompting, the man offers them both a list of suggestions for entertainment and an invitation to dinner with Lord Gabor and his other guests. That day, they wander the grounds, trying to look aimless and relaxed as they memorize the layout and look for weaknesses. They take a tour of the castle, which is more focused on Gabor's eclectic collection than the building itself, but they make mental maps nevertheless. Most enjoyably, they get a chance to wash the road from themselves with luxuriously hot baths. Yusuf stops the servant after two buckets of hot water, feeling bad about asking the man to lug the weight through the entire castle, but that's plenty for him to scrub the dust and grime from his body. By the end, he feels human. He feels much better. But then comes dinner time. Yusuf knows what to prepare himself for this time, but the meal is still a chore. He participates in small talk, listening politely more than speaking, and he refrains from punching Gabor in his self-satisfied face. That's the best he can say about the whole ordeal. At least Gabor doesn't bring the man back out this evening, apparently telling the truth about wanting to save his strength. Yusuf fails to feel grateful for it. One of the other guests tells a story about the time they saw him revive from drowning 5 times in a row, and Yusuf loses his appetite entirely. "Must we really wait until the festival?" he groans after dinner, flopping down onto the lounge before Quinn can. "I would have thought you would appreciate the chance to live in luxury for once," Andromache comments, poking around at a collection of dishes left on their side table. She makes a pleased noise and picks up one of the decanters, pouring its contents out into a goblet. "You're the one drinking Gabor's wine cellars dry," Quinn laughs, taking the goblet for herself, with a kiss to Andromache's cheek. "No amount of hot meals or soft beds would make staying with Gabor worthwhile," Yusuf grumbles. He heaves out a long exhale. "While we are enjoying fine wines, what meals are they granting their prisoner, I wonder?" Quinn pauses mid-sip, frowning at him over the rim of the cup. "Refusing to eat is not going to put food into his belly," she tells him. "Stop feeling guilty." Yusuf lifts his head, opening his mouth to protest, but Andromache cuts him off. "Now there's an idea," she says, stealing the goblet back from Quinn. "What?" Yusuf asks. "You could bring him some food." "What?" he says again, sitting up straight. "Bring him food if you're so worried," Andromache says, raising an eyebrow. "As though you aren't," Yusuf scoffs. "I saw you at dinner tonight, gripping your goblet like it was Gabor's neck." Quinn giggles, and Yusuf turns an unimpressed look on her. "And don't think I didn't notice you eyeing the table knives. They were all far too ornate to be any good at throwing." "I could have made it work," Quinn mutters sullenly. Yusuf ignores her, going back to Andromache's suggestion. "Would Gabor allow it, do you think?" She shrugs. "He did say we could visit." "This would be a good chance to see where he's being kept," Quinn adds. "If he's chained while in his cell where the guards are stationed around him." Yusuf nods. "Do either of you want to go?" Andromache shakes her head. "Gabor might have his guards reporting back to him. All of us going may warrant more interest than we want." "Well, maybe Quinn should go," Yusuf says. "She's the only one who hasn't killed him yet." "I thought you were worried," Quinn counters, tilting her head as she eyes him speculatively. "I am worried," Yusuf protests. "Then you should go." He casts around for an excuse, but he finds none that would hold water. "Fine." "Good." Andromache pulls her canteen from her bag and tosses it to him. "Pay attention to the guard," she orders. "Maybe we can get an idea of their rotations if you keep going back." He stands, fiddling with the canteen in his hands. "What if they expect me to hurt him?" he finally asks. "Then hurt him," Andromache grimaces, running a hand through her hair. "We have to keep our disguise intact." "He will understand," Quinn promises. "Later, once we have freed him." Yusuf looks at her doubtfully, but he doesn't argue. "I hope you're right." He wheedles some soft bread from the kitchens without too much difficulty, managing to turn on the charm much easier with the kitchen staff than with the pompous house guests. He tucks the small loaf away into his pocket, then finds the nearest guard. The guard leads him to the cellars without a word of question. The absurd collection continues down every hallway. Even the stairwells are cluttered with strange paintings and tapestries. As they descend, the air grows cooler and wetter, unpleasant against his skin. Their footsteps echo against the stone, and their shadows flicker ominously in the light of the wall-mounted torches. Only 2 guards stand outside the door they eventually stop in front of. For a split second, Yusuf is tempted to take on all 3 and escape with the man now, but he withholds the urge. 1 door guard pulls out a set of keys as he lazily looks Yusuf up and down. His eyes linger with mild curiosity, on the hilt of Yusuf's scimitar rising over his shoulder. "No serious injuries," he droned, sounding bored. "No killing, no strenuous activity." Yusuf nods, wondering if he should look more eager. "Are they not going to ask for his sword and dagger?" "Approach at your own risk," the guard finishes dully, searching through the keys. "He's a feisty one," he adds, sounding less like a recitation. "Keep your fingers to yourself if you want to keep them." The guards snicker, and Yusuf forces a smile onto his face. "Thank you for the advice," he says through gritted teeth, staring past them at the windowless door. Apparently he does get to retain his weapons. What other instruments of torture have these guards seen enter this room? His heart is pounding in his chest as he thinks of what awaits him in the room beyond. He's about to come face to face with the crusader he thought he left behind years ago. What if the man still wants to murder any Muslim he comes across? What if he didn't actually recognize Yusuf and just thinks he's another torturer? What if Gabor is right and he's no more than a mindless beast? What if... The guard opens the door. Yusuf shoves down his spiraling thoughts and tries to memorize what the correct key looks like. "You'll need this," the other door guard says, reaching up to take one of the torches from the wall and handing it to Yusuf. Then Yusuf is stepping inside and the door is closing behind him. His torch is the only source of light in the room. He squints, straining to adjust his eyes to the gloom beyond the immediate circle of his light. He can vaguely hear the guards talking to each other on the other side of the door, but there is no sound coming from the darkness before him. He turns and finds a wall sconce, setting the torch into it to free his hands. "Hello?" he calls quietly. It isn't a large room. Its walls are the same stone as the cellar hall, cold and rough to the touch. Metal rings are set into various places on the walls and floor. Shadows cling to the corners. He hears a quiet clank from one such corner. He stares hard, and finally his eyes begin making out a shape. "Hello?" he repeats, feeling foolish. "Can you understand me?" he asks, trying to keep his voice low enough that the guards won't hear. He takes a step forward. "I'm here with two women." Another step. "We're like you. Except we don't invade people's homes," he thinks with a tinge of bitterness. As he draws nearer, he can make out more details. The man is curled up in the corner, his tall frame condensed down into something small and defensive. His knees are drawn up, and his arms are twisted behind him. Yusuf can see the glittering of his eyes in the torchlight. His ankles still wear those metal cuffs, chains trailing somewhere behind him. Too late, Yusuf realizes the tension in the man's body is not just due to fear. He was readying himself. The man lunges forward without warning, springing from his hunched position to leap for Yusuf. Yusuf jumps back, just barely in time to avoid a headbutt to his throat. The man's chains snap tight with a loud rattle. He stumbles at the tug to his hands and feet, but does not fall. He snarls at Yusuf, head lowered to protect his own throat. His bright eyes are wild, gleaming from beneath his lowered brow and messy locks of hair. Yusuf takes in a long breath to calm his racing heart, raising his empty hands. "I am not here to hurt you," he says. Perhaps he should have started with that. The man continues to glare, leaning forward into his restraints as he draws himself to his full height. He's slightly shorter than Yusuf, but taller than most of the guards Yusuf has seen around. His body is lean, whether naturally or from starvation, Yusuf doesn't know. His ribs and collarbone stick out unhealthily from his skin. That part is certainly not natural. Beneath his gaunt cheekbones, the muzzle digs cruelly into his face. His scraggly beard sticks out from his jaw in uneven patches, as though recently shorn. The pitiful sight of him unexpectedly drains away Yusuf's lingering hatred for the man. His anger is for someone else. The proud invader who killed Yusuf is not here right now. There is only a tortured soul in need of help. Yusuf slowly reaches a hand into his pocket and pulls out the bread. The man watching him like a hawk all the while. "I brought you food," Yusuf says, holding the bread up. The man glances at the bread, then dismisses it in favor of watching Yusuf. Noriture, Yusuf tries. Chibas, he repeats himself in as many languages as he knows, including the ones where he can barely say a word, food being one of the more important words to learn when traveling in unfamiliar lands. The man shows no sign of understanding. Yusuf risks a step forward and the man quickly steps back. His teeth are bared behind the muzzle, or perhaps he simply can't close his mouth all the way. Up close, Yusuf can see the metal parts shoved into the man's mouth, stilling his tongue and bracing his jaw. You look hungry, Yusuf says. He keeps his tone light, figuring the tone may help, even if the words can't. As nauseating as the comparison is, he feels like a man taming a skittish animal. As seconds pass without anything happening, the man drops his gaze to scan over Yusuf's body. His eyes catch on the hilt of Yusuf's scimitar, and he stills. Do you recognize it? Yusuf asks, genuinely curious. This is the sword that first killed you. He takes another step, and the man scuttles back until he reaches the wall. Was his initial regression only a feint? Or is this the feint, drawing Yusuf in, only to attack again? The man watches him warily as he half crouches in the corner. Yusuf makes a decision. He steps back out of reach of the chains all the way to the door. Then he slowly draws the scimitar, watching as the man tenses further, and he sets the blade on the ground. He also removes his dagger from his hip and lays it beside the sword. When he returns to stand before the man, those eyes are no less wary, but they flick back to the abandoned weapons several times. You see, Yusuf says. He considers the man for a moment and decides it would be extremely difficult for him to inflict any damage on Yusuf in his current restraints. Yusuf takes another risk and sinks to the ground within arm's reach, sitting cross-legged on the cold stone. The man crouches further, his legs covering his vulnerable crotch and belly, and his shoulders strain uselessly against his chains in an attempt to bring his arms forward. He stares at Yusuf. His greasy hair hangs limply in front of his face, nearly obscuring his vision. Yusuf can see it move with every breath the man takes, fast and shallow. The longer Yusuf sits without doing anything, the slower the man's breathing gets, but he remains vigilant, barely blinking. Will you eat? Yusuf asks, keeping his voice low. He examines the muzzle and frowns, realizing it will be impossible for the man to chew. How did they usually feed him? I will give it to you in small pieces, yes? He tears off a tiny bit of bread and holds it up, not yet reaching out. The man's eyes flick to the morsel before returning to Yusuf. Look, Yusuf says, and he pops the bread into his own mouth. He chews more than this piece really requires, then swallows heavily. Now you. He tears off another small bite and slowly reaches out his hand, wincing internally as the man shrinks back. Go on, he urges. You need to eat. The moment the bread touches the man's bottom lip, he flinches back and hits his head against the wall. Feeling uncomfortably like he's torturing the man, Yusuf tries again, now that he has nowhere to go. This time he manages to push the bread into the man's mouth. Yusuf pulls back immediately, clasping his hands together in his lap. He waits and waits. Finally, the man's throat works and he gulps down the piece of bread with a jerk of his head. He looks like a bird swallowing a fish whole. Good, Yusuf says with an encouraging nod. Again? He holds out another piece. The man doesn't flinch quite as hard this time when Yusuf puts it in his mouth, and he swallows it without as long of a pause. He doesn't look away from Yusuf, his eyes narrowed. They slowly make their way through all the bread Yusuf brought with him. Yusuf takes to speaking just to fill the silence, and maybe break through the man's uncomprehending stare. He tells the man about Andromache and Quinn, about how they were searching for him, about their meeting with Emil. I am Yusuf, he introduces himself as an afterthought, one hand coming to rest on his own chest. The man's gaze flicks down to the hand. I hope we will know your name soon. When the food is gone, Yusuf reaches down and unhooks the canteen from his belt. The movement makes the man tense. "I brought water as well," Yusuf says, holding up the canteen. He opens it and takes a sip. "Tilt your head back?" he asks, even though he doubts the man understands him. He holds the canteen out higher than the man's mouth. He will have to pour the water directly in. He doesn't know how to communicate the concept. Should he risk putting a hand beneath the man's chin to guide him? But to his surprise, the man moves his head away from the wall far enough to tilt back, his eyes fixed on the canteen. Yusuf carefully lets some water spill out into his mouth. "You remember what a canteen is," he murmurs. "A good sign. His humanity can't be totally gone." The man gulps the water down in painfully loud swallows, likely swallowing a significant amount of air as he does. Yusuf keeps the stream going as the man shows no sign of stopping. He chokes once, and Yusuf stops pouring while the man coughs and sputters. But a few seconds later, the man tilts his head back again. The canteen empties quickly. When the water is gone, the man lowers his chin to its usual defensive position and watches Yusuf. The wariness is still there, but the fear is reduced somewhat, or perhaps Yusuf is imagining it. "We are going to get you out of here," he tells the man, "Andromache Quinn and myself. We're like you." He wonders if proving their shared gift might gain more of the man's trust or bring him to his senses. Yusuf stands and retrieves his dagger. The man instantly presses himself back into the wall and growls deep in his throat. "No, no," Yusuf says, hands raised as his heart throbs with pity. "It's not for you. Look." He stands out of reach and rolls up his sleeve, then slices a long, shallow scratch along his forearm. He tosses the dagger back to the ground and edges closer. "See? Look. I am like you." He swipes away the line of blood with one hand, holding his healed forearm out to the man. The man quiets. His bright eyes stare at the unbroken skin, unblinking. "You killed me," Yusuf says quietly, "and I came back to life just as you did." He waits, looking for some sort of recognition in the man's gaze, something to indicate that the man, from before this imprisonment, is still in there. Deep shadows spill over the man's face as the torch flickers, its flame sputtering low. Yusuf curses under his breath. "I had better go. I'm not supposed to spend much time with you." He steps back, fetching and resheathing his weapons. He pulls the failing torch out of its sconce. Then he pauses at the door, meeting the man's eyes and not sure what to say. "Do you say goodbye to someone who can't understand you?" "I will be back," he says eventually. The man, huddled in his dark corner, doesn't react. He looks nothing like the imposing soldier who struck Yusuf down that day on the battlefield, except for the eyes. After a moment, Yusuf turns and knocks on the door. He leaves without a backward glance, but the image of the man in his cell follows him for the rest of the day. Chapter 7. Wasting Time. The remaining days before the festival pass with excruciating slowness. By day, the three of them continue wandering the halls and grounds, making note of servants' quarters and guard locations. Quinn goes for a ride and comes back with detailed directions to a rendezvous point planned out in case they are separated. Andromache sharpens every one of their weapons until they could cut a strand of hair. Yusuf sits with his sketchbook and tries to draw something other than those pale eyes that won't leave him alone. At night, they suffer through meals with Gabor and his growing crowd of guests. Thankfully, Gabor allows them to sit there, more or less passively, his attention caught by more recent arrivals. He does catch Yusuf's eye once, leaning over to say, "I hear you paid a visit to my beast today. I trust he entertained you properly." He raises his eyebrows expectantly. Yusuf forces a smile and a nod after Quinn kicks him under the table. "Yes, I was pleasantly surprised." "Good, good," Gabor smirks at him. "Pleasant enough to warrant another visit after the festival? No part of my beast is off limits to a friend of Emil, the one who sold me my favorite toy." It's all Yusuf can do to murmur his agreement with some semblance of positive interest. I know he's not yet fully broken in, Gabor continues apologetically, oblivious to Yusuf's simmering anger. He bites, he fights his leashes. It takes a lot to get him to beg, too, he says offhandedly into his goblet. Beg, Yusuf repeats hollowly. He pictures the straight-backed crusader of his memories wielding his sword with self-righteousness blazing from his face and determination writ in every inch of him. He tries to imagine that man begging. Gabor hums around his mouthful of wine, nodding. Some people like it. I don't much care either way, but for my guests, I've been trying to train him, mostly with food, he chuckles. He's a stubborn thing, though. Yusuf fed the man bread by hand this afternoon. If he'd known even that had been turned into a twisted sort of game, well, he still would have done it. The man needs to eat, but he would have felt guilty about it. At least the man didn't beg for his scraps. Yusuf isn't sure he could handle seeing the once proud warrior brought that low. Yusuf tries to go see the man again the next day with another pocket full of bread, but he's turned away at the door. Someone else is already having fun with him, the guard tells him. He makes an effort to look disappointed and not disgusted, stalking away with his fists carefully unclenched. By the next time he tries, Gabor has stopped letting anyone visit the man at all, citing the festival. Yusuf is torn between relief and anxiety. At least the man isn't being actively harmed, but the thought of him rattled in the darkness keeps Yusuf awake at night. I could have built up some trust, he laments, the evening before the festival begins in their shared living room. If I went every day and brought him food and water, spoke to him. Andromache and Quinn, having heard this several times already, don't bother to reply. Have you heard when his event is? Andromache asks as she sorts through a pile of clothes. She had been bored enough today to go hunting for clothes for the man after all, and she somehow managed to sneak an entire basket out from the laundry room, after being washed and dried, no less. She tosses another pair of too large trousers back into the basket before glancing up at Yusuf. He shakes his head, but Quinn says grimly, "At midday." Andromache pauses with a ridiculous silk shirt held out in front of her. On the first day, she repeats with a frown. Every day. Yusuf swears. They had hoped Gabor would save the special event for later, giving them a window during which they could sneak him away amidst the drunken revelry. But they have no such luck. Andromache sighs. We can't take him now. Not with Gabor's guards making sure to keep everyone away. He'll have to fight at least once. And then we leave that night, Quinn says, twirling a small knife in her hand. Yes, no matter what. Chapter 8. The Arena. The first day of the festival dawns bright and cheerful. The castle has been transformed. Tents and booths litter the grounds, and the air is filled with the noise of people and animals. Livestock lays about in temporary pens, waiting to be ridden or sold or served up as a meal. As the morning ages, guests pour in through the gates and carriages on horseback and on foot. Children chase each other through the growing crowd, and men with hands on their weapons size each other up over the competition sign-ups. In sum, it would be a delightful sight if it weren't for the sadistic host. Lord Gabor does not mingle. People come to him. He sits on a raised platform at one end of the main courtyard, dressed in expensively dyed finery and sipping on aged wine. He holds court as his more important guests approach to offer their greetings and compliments. Yusuf does not approach. He wanders through the festival, his worries preventing him from enjoying the sights. He finds himself by a small pen of ponies, and he gives a pat to the one that noses at his empty pockets. He nods amicably to the guards standing at seemingly random points on the grounds. He buys a bag of candied nuts, but tucks them away after the first few fail to sweeten his mood. Most of all, he waits for midday. Finally, a ringing bell and a crier call the crowd to the first competition of the festival. The sun shines high overhead. Midday has arrived. Yusuf hurries to the temporary amphitheater erected on one of the sprawling lawns. He looks for Andromache and Quinn, but he doesn't see them in the crowd. They had agreed to stay apart, so as to improve their chances of seizing any opportunity that may arise. Still, he would have liked the reassurance of seeing their faces. The arena is positioned with a natural cliffside at its back. It's not an impossible climb, nor especially tall, perhaps the height of three men stacked, but it is treacherously steep enough to act as a wall. The other sides are hemmed in with raised platforms and benches, quickly filling with interested festival-goers. Yusuf finds himself a seat with a view, somewhere close enough to see, but off to the side so he can slip out more easily if needed. More importantly, the seat is not within reach of Gabor. The Lord himself sits dead center at the top row, seated in a carved chair and wearing an immensely pleased expression. Four men stand in the rough circle of the arena, each armed with bladed weapons but wearing only plain clothing and no armor. They don't look at each other. One keeps glancing up nervously at the crowds, shifting his grip on his spear. The bald one seems to be praying. Another is staring down at his sword like he isn't sure what it is. These must be the criminals Gabor mentioned. Have they been forced, or did they volunteer to risk their lives for their freedom? Yusuf feels a stab of pity for them. He doesn't know what crimes they committed, but fighting in this arena at the whim of their lord hardly seems fair, especially when everyone believes their opponent to be a monster, a beast. And yet everyone loves to see a beast, so long as it isn't their neck on the line. The crowd cheers when they bring him out. Yusuf tenses in his seat, gripping the rough edge of the bench to keep himself in place. The guards handle him much as before, dragging him by his manacled wrists and jabbing him with their spears. He fights more than he did in the castle hall, straining against the ropes and digging in his heels. His head whips around wildly at the yelling spectators on all sides. Yusuf wonders if he's been forced to fight in front of such a crowd before. His heart aches even as he grinds his teeth in anger. They force the man to his knees in the middle of the arena. He tries to stand again, but a guard kicks him in the stomach and he doubles over again. They have not given him any clothing. His skin has an unhealthy pale sheen in the sunlight. His hair hangs limp and dirty. In the bright light of day, amidst so many people well-fed and well-clothed, the man truly looks more beast than human. Gabor stands and waves for silence. He smiles brightly at the crowd, spreading his hands benevolently. "Welcome," he proclaims, "to the first spectacle." He waits while a few people cheer and clap. "What you see before you is something special, something inexplicable, something monstrous." Yusuf tunes out the rest of the speech in favor of watching the man kneeling in the grass. He isn't fighting now, holding still but for his eyes jumping from person to person. Yusuf doesn't realize he's holding his breath until his chest starts to ache. Their eyes meet. The man doesn't look startled. He doesn't look betrayed or resigned or disappointed. Nothing so nuanced. No. Staring over the heads of bloodthirsty spectators, squinting in the light of day, the man's face shows nothing at all for several long heartbeats. Then the crowd laughs at something Gabor is saying. Yusuf watches the man's face twist as anger floods back in. Gabor is annoyed when the man's renewed struggling interrupts his speech with murmurs from the audience, and he cuts his pontificating short in favor of commencing the fight. "Kill him three times yourself and your debt is paid," he says plainly, waving a hand disinterestedly to the four criminals. Turning to address the crowd again, he announces more theatrically, "Behold the beast!" A guard steps forward with a sword in hand and without a moment's hesitation stabs the man in the heart. More than one scream sounds from the audience. Distantly, Yusuf thinks they should not have allowed children to watch. The man dies, falling over sideways with the sword still in his chest. The guards make quick work of his bindings, releasing him from his ankle cuffs as well as removing the ropes on his wrists, though they leave his hands cuffed together in front of him. The muzzle is also removed, gingerly. The man twitches a few times throughout this process, but with one guard maintaining pressure on the sword, he does not revive long enough to do very much. Then the guards are stepping to the edges of the arena, the one with the sword withdrawing it with difficulty and backing away quickly. The crowd waits with bated breath, and Yusuf waits with them. "Get up," he thinks. "Wake up!" The man jerks upright to the sounds of several more screams and a large number of gasps. He struggles to his feet, awkwardly pushing himself up with his bound hands. His chest is already scarlet, drenched in lifeblood. He works his jaw, hands rising to his mouth to feel for the muzzle that's no longer there. "Begin," yells Gabor from his throne. The man's head whips toward Gabor. The men in the arena advance. The crowd roars. Yusuf prepares himself for an extremely unpleasant show. The boldest of the criminals approaches without hesitation. He swings his sword in a large sweeping arc that the man easily evades by simply stepping to one side. He tries it again to the other side, and again the man steps out of range. The man is holding up his bound hands, palms out as though pleading, though Yusuf can see he is not speaking a word. The others hang back, either waiting their turn or stalling. The first fighter is more skilled than he appeared. A third time he swings wide and obvious, and the man dodges to the side once more, but the sword is already on its way into his gut. His mouth falls open, but whatever noise he makes is drowned out by the cheering of the audience. A bell sounds and a crier yells over the din. "One!" The man isn't dead, but Yusuf supposes they're counting what would be killing blows on any normal man. He is glad for it. The less damage the man has to suffer, the better. The man staggers back as the fighter withdraws his sword, bound hands moving to cover the closing wound in his belly. He retreats on unsteady legs, tripping as he moves backwards without looking away from the armed man before him. But there is nowhere to go. Soon his back hits the cliff wall, and he is trapped. He raises his hands again in a ready position. His attacker lunges forward into a rapid series of blows. The man dodges as much as he can, but he gains a slice down his flank, his forearm, his shoulder, and blood streams down his body. A deep cut to his thigh makes him stumble. Before he can regain his balance, there is a sword in his throat. He does die this time, crumpling to the ground in a bloody heap. The noise of the crowd hums around Yusuf as though from a long distance away. Somewhere a bell rings. "Two!" the crier yells. "Wake up," Yusuf thinks again. "Come back." Apparently now confident in his abilities fighting a chained and naked man, the first fighter steps back and looks around at the crowd. He could technically wait until the man returns to life and immediately cut his throat again, but Yusuf supposes that would fail to please Lord Gabor. Instead, he waits for a fresh fight, looking to the crowd as they roar in their excitement. It's a mistake. The man revives quickly and moves before anyone realizes he is healed. He doesn't even get up off the ground fully, launching himself directly at his killer's knees and taking them both to the ground. In an instant, the man has a knee in the fighter's stomach and cuffed hands clumsily wrapped around his throat. The fighter has lost his grip on his sword and is scrabbling in the grass to reach the hilt. Yusuf leans forward, caught up in the sight of the man fighting back. The fighter tries to buck him off and beats at him with his knees and free arm, but the man just takes the blows and doesn't let up. His teeth are bared as he leans his weight into his killer's throat. He's bloody and furious and terrifying. He's glorious. And then he's dead again. Another sword shoved through his throat. A second fighter has crept forward, stealing a cowardly chance to get his first kill. "One," counts the crier over the bell, even as half the crowd boos its disapproval. The man slumps to the ground, and his first attacker rolls away, still conscious. Yusuf curses internally, having already forgotten his pity for the criminal minutes before. The second man seems to have no concept of an honorable fight. though this fight could never truly be so, not with their opponent, so outnumbered and disadvantaged. And he unimaginatively cuts the man's throat again as soon as he begins to stir. The crowd rumbles discontentedly. After a few beats, the crier calls, "Two, but do better for the third." The second man looks back to where Gabor is frowning at him, and he visibly blanches. His distraction seals his fate. He doesn't see the man coming a second later, already alive and even angrier. The man bowls into him, staggering him backwards. They grapple in close quarters, spinning in a confusing flash of pale skin and undyed clothing. In their tangle of limbs, somehow the cuffed man manages to get control over the sword. There is a moment where the world seems to slow. Yusuf sees him hesitate. Then the criminal is reaching desperately for the hilt, and the man is returning the sword straight through his killer's throat. The crowd screams and roars. Yusuf simply nods with great satisfaction, darkly pleased by the mirroring. But the sense of justice disappears when the man goes down again under a hail of crossbow bolts. A handful of guards quickly approach, fresh crossbows pointed at the man's unmoving figure. One hurries forward and seizes the sword from an unresisting hand, and then they all retreat to the sidelines once more. It seems the man is not allowed a weapon. Yusuf glances to Gabor, whose mood has turned positively sour. That is not ideal. A lord unsatisfied with his showbeast performance is a man more likely to inflict punishment later. By the time the man revives once more, crossbow bolts dropping out of his blood-covered body to litter the stained grass around him, his first attacker has regained his feet and is waiting. The man takes up another defensive stance, but it cannot last against the clear skill of his armed opponent. He suffers several more wounds before dying with another sword to his heart. Three! The first criminal retreats to the sidelines, one hand holding his dripping sword, and the other gingerly massaging his throat. He looks to Gabor and receives a regal nod, perhaps guaranteeing his promised freedom. The other two surviving criminals begin to advance as one. The taller holds two blades, a short sword and a dagger. The other wields a spear. Yusuf lets out a breath. Halfway done. Soon it will be over. The man is slow to rise this time, reviving, but moving his limbs sluggishly. He must be tiring. Too little activity or food combined with this much healing is taking its toll. The armed men circle around him, one to either side, an impossible threat for him to defend against. Yusuf looks to Gabor to see if he will demand a fairer fight, and thus a prolonged and more interesting one. But Gabor says nothing. Yusuf remembers suddenly that Gabor once forced the man to fight a bear, and he is no longer surprised. The man whips his head back and forth, spinning in place as he tries to track both attackers at once. A trapped animal once again, surrounded by predators. The fighter with the spear attacks first, stabbing at the man's back, but he misses the heart and fails to kill the man. The crier is silent. The man's face is contorted with pain as the spear is yanked back out, but he still finds the energy to block a swipe of the short sword with his forearms. The blade cuts to the bone and comes back out more easily than the spear had. The man dodges to one side suddenly enough to avoid another stab of the spear from behind, but it leaves him open to another blow of the short sword from the front. It catches him in the side, slipping between his ribs and bringing him to his knees. The man's mouth falls open. Yusuf thinks he must be crying out. He clenches his fists tightly as "One!" rings out over the crowd's yells. It's almost over, he reminds himself. The armed men wait for him to regain his feet, perhaps having learned from the crier's earlier warning for the now dead criminal. He finds his balance again shakily, his arms up before his throat are unsteady. It seems no part of him remains unpainted with blood besides his face, bone white beneath the mess of hair and beard. The fight reminds Yusuf of a boar hunt he once witnessed, Men hemmed in the dangerous animal on all sides, harrying it and keeping its attention split, wounding it again and again as it weakened and slowed and eventually died. In the same way, the swordsmen and the spearmen take turns attacking, opening up long slices and tearing holes in his unprotected body. The man with the blades at least seems to be aiming for incapacitating or killing blows. The spearman either has terrible aim or is intentionally only wounding the man, his spear stabbing into the man's arms and legs as often as his back. At one point, the man dodges the next slice of the short sword and manages to parry the follow-up attack of the dagger with his wrist cuffs, but the spear wielder takes advantage of his momentary stillness by stabbing him directly in the ass cheek. It doesn't do much besides cause the man to stumble, but the crowd laughs and jeers, and moments later the sword is cutting his throat. "Two!" calls the crier. Once he recovers, the man goes on the offensive again. He lunges for the attacker with two blades and beats his fists into the criminal's face, a hoarse cry ripping from his likely still healing throat. The attacker staggers back, stunned, but he brings his dagger up and plunges it into the man's back. Once, twice, three times, he stabs as the man continues to swing his fists together. The fourth stab lands in the same time as the man's fists connect with the criminal's jaw. They both crumple to the ground. Three! A few moments pass before the man moves again. He rolls off his killer's body but makes no move to attack him further, either unaware or uncaring that the criminal is only unconscious instead of dead. Yusuf hopes for the latter. They may be able to help a man who has lost parts of his humanity, but a dumb beast set on killing would be more difficult to rehabilitate. Though admittedly, a dumb, murderous beast is how Yusuf originally saw all the Crusaders. The fourth criminal doesn't wait for the recovering man to stand or even sit up. As the man stirs, the spearman jumps into action. He runs forward and stabs his spear down directly into the man's crotch. The man screams, audible even over the noise of the crowd. Every man in the audience winces simultaneously, crying out in shock or yelling with a bloodthirsty, perverse pleasure. Yusuf promises himself to track this criminal down and kill him later. One, the crier calls over the pounding in Yusuf's ears. He doesn't bother wondering why this blow counts. He just worries it will encourage the criminal to do it again. The man lurches to his feet, blood and fluids dripping down his legs. He bares his teeth and bends his knees, ready to leap. His bright eyes are wild and intensely fixed on his attacker. He looks like a madman. Without another fighter to provide distraction, and with the man back on his feet instead of incapacitated on the ground, the spearman struggles to land another blow. He keeps the man at bay with his long weapon, but his attacks are easily dodged, even with the man's exhaustion evident. The crowd roars its encouragement, but the spearman's attacks grow sloppier, more frantic. After dodging another clumsy thrust, the man manages to grab hold of the spear shaft with both hands. He wrenches back, and the spear comes free. Instead of going after his weapon, the attacker stupidly backpedals out of reach, his back to Yusuf's section. Yusuf tenses, waiting for the crossbow bolts to fly, but the man drops the spear to the side without a second glance. His gaze never leaves the criminal as he prowls forward, death in his eyes. The unarmed attacker holds up his hands as though to ward him off, his head turning and his gaze flicking to Gabor. "He will not save you," Yusuf thinks coldly. He can still hear the man's tortured scream as he was stabbed. He can't find a shred of pity in his heart for this criminal. The man pounces. He knocks the weaponless fighter to the ground, his bound hands on the man's chest, and his knees bracketing the man's hips. Yusuf expects him to strangle the man, awkward as it is with cuffed hands, but he doesn't. Instead, he drops down, and with a vicious twist of his head, he rips out the criminal's throat with his teeth. Yusuf remains frozen in his seat as the crowd screams around him. They don't care who lives or dies. They only want to see the blood. And blood there is. The man was already drenched in it. Now fresh viscera drip from his lips and beard as he raises his head from the ruined neck. Blood spurts from the fatal wound, painting his face. His eyes are wild as he glares into the stands, his bared teeth red as he hunches over the body like a predator over its meal. In that moment, for the first time in Yusuf's eyes, he is monstrous. So that is why they removed his muzzle, Yusuf thinks, almost hysterically. He remembers his own fingers touching the man's lips as he fed him bread. His fingers can grow back, true, but that's beside the point. The bloody killer before him is hard to reconcile with the skittish prisoner he hand-fed only days ago. The man does not look for him in the stands. His eyes move endlessly but never seem to see anything. Gabor is saying something over the noises of the excited audience, gesturing grandly to the only man still standing in the arena, the first fighter. Two of the criminals lie dead in the grass. The last remains lying still but will recover. And the man at the center of it all remains on his knees over the man he brutally killed, his chest heaving and his arms trembling under his weight. He barely fights the guards when they come for him. They don't even have to kill him to get him back into his restraints, his movements slow and uncoordinated. They pile on him and force him to lie on his front as they chain his ankles again. One guard holds the muzzle, but they don't attempt to put it on. Yusuf looks again at the bloody mess of the fourth criminal's throat, and he doesn't blame them. "I trust this was entertaining for you all," Gabor is saying, a smile back in place. Yusuf hopes it's genuine. If it isn't, the man will be forced to pay the price. "Please join me again tomorrow for another bout, and in the meantime, enjoy the rest of the festival." The guards drag the man to his feet and refasten ropes to his wrist cuffs. His head hangs low, his hair hiding his face from view. He sways on his feet. Yusuf watches as they take him away. It could have been him, he thinks. It could have been Yusuf trudging forward in chains, covered in his own blood. It could have been him who left two men dead after being thrown in a ring with nothing but his healing gift. It could have been him frightening the children, his hair overgrown, his beard unkempt, his ribs sticking out, and his skin faded to an unhealthily light shade from the darkness of his cell. Why me? Yusuf has often thought as he pondered this miraculous power of theirs. As he saw men and women and children die undeserved deaths, while he would rise again and again. But this time, as he watches the man's bloodied and bent back disappear, Yusuf wonders, why him? Chapter 9. We leave tonight. Were you there? Yusuf asks when he reconvenes with Andromache and Quinn in their rooms that evening. The women nod, their faces tight. None of them say anything else about it. Perhaps later they will speak of it, share their thoughts, and exorcise their demons. But for now, it is enough that they all witnessed. For now, they have a job to do. We'll get him out tonight, Andromache says firmly. No one argues. No one wants to. Her eyes slide to Quinn. Have you picked a horse? Yes, and a better route than the front gates, Quinn says promptly. It will be trickier riding, but will be better hidden. Andromache nods. Good. You get our mounts ready. I'll deal with the guards as necessary. Yusuf? Yes, Yusuf says, eager for something to do, for something to distract him. That scream is still ringing in his ears. You go to him. Yusuf hesitates for only a heartbeat before agreeing. Fine. But he saw me in the audience. Whatever trust I may have garnered is likely broken. Andromache shrugs tiredly. Deal with it. He won't trust us tonight. She goes to their bags and draws out a cloak, one of the items she kept from the laundry. Tossing it to Yusuf, she says, you should go now. Do anything you have to keep others away. Delay. Stall. We can't leave until dark. Yusuf twists the cloak between his hands. But he's meant to fight against tomorrow. Gabor will not allow anyone in. Find a way, Andromache orders. Say Gabor sent you, Quinn suggests. Her mouth twists as she scowls. He was not happy with how he stole the sword. Likely he wants to punish him. So I have to pretend to be his torturer, Yusuf protests. I can't keep up that farce and have any hope of bringing him with me willingly afterwards. He doesn't say that he thinks he could not bring himself to harm the man. When they are both armed and on opposite sides of the battlefield, certainly. Not when the man is chained and helpless and has already died 8 times today. Yusuf, Andromache says, resting her hands on his shoulders. There is no good way forward. We work with what we have. He lets out a short sigh. You're right. You're right. I will do what I must. Good boy, she says, patting his cheek in what should be an infuriatingly patronizing gesture, but which from her only feels like fond praise. Be flexible and be ready to go at sunset. We will come for you and bring the keys. She hesitates uncharacteristically before adding, and the chains. Yusuf forces himself not to argue about this again. He just nods and throws the cloak over his shoulders, then heads for the door. He will find a way to make this work. They will not need the chains. The man will be fine, and they will all make it out of here just fine. It's all going to be fine.